known Len for a long time, and Len has been a big friend of the University of Saskatchewan and of the province of Saskatchewan. He's from Melfort, Saskatchewan, and is one of the many public servants who left the province of Saskatchewan and went on to great things in Ottawa. In Len's case, mostly in the international affairs field. He's been, among other things, a ambassador to Korea and to Vietnam.
No, Japan.
Japan. See what you did?
I like Vietnam. I like Vietnam.
You have been in Vietnam, though.
Yeah, okay. I have.
That's right.
Have.
And in Ottawa, Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, of Agriculture and Food, and of International Trade. Len really is an international specialist. Among other things, he's really been an organizing force behind G8 and G20 summits. And he's been here on a number of occasions, including forums that we've had and co-sponsored with the Asia-Pacific Foundation. So, and it really is Asia that is Len's area of expertise, although he's really helped us in a whole host of things that I should mention. One of them is he's a director of VITO Intervac, which is one of the major scientific installations currently on this campus. So, Len Edwards is a big friend of the School of Public Policy, a big friend of the University of Saskatchewan, and an extremely accomplished public servant, and now an academic. So CG, for those of you who don't know, is located at the University of Waterloo, and I was just perusing the long list of distinguished people that are associated with CG, and it is a long list, and Len is one of the most distinguished. So, and Benoit is with Len, and is going to join in and ask and answer maybe some of the questions. And so the Len's talk will be relatively short by academic standards, but I know that you guys will have lots of questions, and so we'll go from there. So Len, turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you everybody in this room and in the room in Regina. It's actually, you gave the impression that there was no one around, so the fact is there's so many people here is wonderful, and so I thank you all for taking the time to come and listen to me. I'm here with Benoit because together we've been working on a project for over a year now. In fact, it's almost a good year and a half, to look at the Canada-Indonesia relationship, and really from the ground up. I have a bit of experience in Indonesia. I went there for my first visits back in the 1980s. I was the APEC senior official when the famous Bogor APEC meeting took place, and the Bogor Declaration, which still resounds to the region as a sort of a first statement around the desire of Asia-Pacific countries to build a common trade and economic zone. So Indonesia wasn't unfamiliar to me, but I had never been posted there. As Michael says, I've had other postings in Asia, but in the course of covering Asia for many years, I got to know Indonesia reasonably well. And it always struck me as a country that, and I'll say this a little later on, just is both here and not here in terms of Canadian consciousness. And add to that the fact that over the recent years, Canada has been rather inconstant in its approach to Asia-Pacific, really since the 1997 financial crisis. Has added to, I think, the dilemma, and I'll put it that way, that we face in our relationship with this rather extraordinary country. In Asia, generally, we have displayed sort of energetic engagement and vision at times, and then other times we've demonstrated that we are uncertain about whether or not we are in Canada truly an Asia-Pacific country, and we're a member of the Asia-Pacific community, and we are ready to make the investments that you need to make to become a member, an accepted member of it. So this kind of ambivalence, this coming and going, is much noticed by your Asia-Pacific partners, who culturally, as you all know, value relationships and commitment. And they have it's led to, I believe, negative consequences for Canadian interests. I think our ability to perform against very tough competition economically has impacted on our ability to extract value from those from our relationship in relationships in Asia, and and I've seen this firsthand, to garner support for foreign policy positions, for our membership on the Security Council, where I made my own little tour through Asia at the end of my career, and I think I got some successes, but I know that we were not doing as well as we should have. And also our ability to look after, you know, at sort of a fundamental level, our citizens in the region when they get when they enter in distress. So Canada's ties with. So what is Indonesia? Well, first of all, it's one of the farthest countries from Canadian shores, and it seems to sit at the margins of Canadian consciousness. Despite Indonesia's huge size and population, its economic performance, and growing political clout regionally and globally as a G20 member, Canadians have been best ambivalent. You know, sometimes I try to take this apart because I think awareness is a huge issue. Factor. And, you know, what do Canadians think of Indonesia? Well, many of them see it as a slightly exotic country, a little bit over the horizon, the old Spice Islands, former Dutch possession and colony. They see it in tourism terms because Bali's a great tourism destination and many Canadians have gone there. But they also see it in terms of its political history. With under Sukarno and then later under Suharto, sort of the ex-military dictatorships or autocracies, the accompanying suppression of human rights, sometimes the pogroms against Chinese citizens, and then of course there is the issue of East Timor or Timor-Leste, which has and the struggle that that country had and the bloody suppression of its independence. So these days, unfortunately, I think that we're sort of faced with this uphill battle around awareness. Yet on the these perceptions are out of date. On the broader scale, Indonesia has now become one of the most vital, if imperfect, democracies, newer democracies in the world. It's a model of harmony and tolerance, but with challenges. As a young population, 40% of Indonesians are under 25 years old. It's more engaged politically. These young people are increasingly mobile with economic aspirations, and they're among the world's most digitally connected people. And Indonesia's the third largest use of Twitter, for example. So these raw numbers and the challenges of governance and connectivity are staggering. All you have to do is look at a map. If you look at take Indonesia out of the Asia Pacific Mercator map and you stick it over Canada, you'll find that it's wider or from end to end than Canada is wide. Just, but it's quite remarkable when you think of trying to govern a country across those huge distances of over 5,000 kilometers, 17,500 islands or whatever they are, with many of them uninhabited, but with different ethnic groups and so on. But against all of that, Indonesia is an economic giant in the making. At 255 million people, Indonesia is the world's fourth largest population in the world. It's the largest Muslim nation. 53% of Indonesians live in cities, and that figure is expected to grow to over 70% by 2030. It's now the 16th largest economy in GDP terms, and that's not PPP, that's GDP terms. Indonesia is predicted by McKinsey to pass Canada and rise to number 7 in the world by 2030. So, and while growth rates have tended to soften recently because of the decline in Chinese demand for Indonesian commodities, it still enjoys a dynamic growth rate in the range of 5.5%. Which puts it just behind India, now the fastest growing Asian country, and a slowing China. So, and finally, Indonesia is the power that, or the engine that empowers ASEAN, Southeast Asia. It represents 40% of the ASEAN economic output. It's a gateway to Southeast Asia. Strategically, it sits aside these critical shipping lanes that are now being much discussed and followed with in the South China Seas, and that connects China, Japan, Korea, and the rest of East Asia to Europe and beyond. So these are pretty, important facts, and I don't think many Canadians see them in sort of the stark terms that I've just set them up. But why aren't we doing something about it? That's the big question. Why have we been such a recent laggard? You know, we didn't used to be. And again, I go back to my own memories, and I may be wrong, but I'll tell you my memories in those days, whereas we were present. We were quite active. INCO was a big investor in Indonesia. Canada had a profile there because of that investment, because of other activities as well. We had influence, more influence there than we had today. And the funny thing is that Indonesians still remember it, the older ones, and would welcome us back. And we learned that at this project we were working on when we had our forum there in Jakarta over a year ago. Furthermore, many Canadian companies, institutions, individuals remain engaged and deeply engaged in Indonesia, just not enough of them. And without the consistent high-level political support that's needed from governments. Our development program there has historically been very strong and remains so. And this is a solid foundation on which to build. It's currently focusing, and I'll come back to that, very much sort of on institution building and governance, as well as on economic themes. And we have, you know, such institutions as the IDRC, the Parliamentary Center, the Conference Board, are involved in projects in Indonesia. So this solid foundation. What do we do with it? Well, this is one of the questions that we in CG wanted to tackle when we joined with this prestigious center in Jakarta called CSIS, which is the Center for Strategic International Studies. And it's headed by Indonesia's probably best-known internationalist. You may know him, or certainly have heard of him, Yosef Wenandi. He's very elderly these days, but he is still regarded around the region as one of the sort of giants of Indonesia internationalism and thinking. Very closely connected, unfortunately, for a while with the Suharto regime, and he's only sort of recently sort of come back in terms of influence. But CSIS is an important institution, and it was well positioned to provide us with a good delegation of Indonesians to match up with the 30 or so Canadians that we brought to Jakarta. Some of them were there, of course, to discuss the relationship. The report that we have looks like this in print, and some of you have it, if not all of you. It's available on the website at CG for those who don't and want to have access to it or want to download it or show it around. I think it's a very good document, in all modesty. I haven't seen anything quite like it on Indonesia. And the kind of reception we're getting, I think, points that out, that this is a very welcome thing. So where do we come out on this report? Well, I would summarize it as following, that if you are looking at what Indonesia is and is becoming, that we shouldn't be satisfied with incrementalism and add-ons. We need big ideas for a big country, for the big opportunities that exist there. So I'm going to give you sort of four such big ideas that are set out in here that sort of build on what we looked at as sort of the natural drivers. What are the drivers that bring us together? And four of them stand out. First, Canada and Indonesia have a natural thematic commonality as maritime nations. And this can be used as a compelling kind of narrative to energize a whole number of areas of activity. For instance, both countries face the challenges of securing long coastlines. We have the longest coastline in the world. Indonesia is the second longest coastline in the world. We have issues around asserting sovereignty, overseeing activities in the economic zone, passageways through Canadian waters and Indonesian waters. The opening of the so-called North Canadian Northwest Passage is one of is the main point from our perspective, providing rescue and services and other services in the maritime space. We both have extensive fisheries resources. Canada's own experience in managing its fisheries resources could be very useful in Indonesia's current efforts to manage their stocks more effectively and control illegal foreign fishing. Both countries face the challenges of communicating, moving energy, shipping, and traveling over long distances, with the resulting demands for modern infrastructure. And both face the challenges of remote communities and the attendant social and economic issues. that interfere with the effective practice of democracy to the availability of economic opportunity. So that's the first theme, big idea that I think we can use to build a stronger, better relationship. Second, I referred to the development assistance program. And I think we can really do some more work there, building on the two main themes that we now have, sharing best practices on democratic governance, elections, federalism, and effective public service. The Indonesians have a serious corruption issue. A lot of that has to do with an effective government public service, has to do with systems and so on of governance and regulation. Even just applying for permits for energy development opens a whole door to corruption that's quite extraordinary. Well, there are ways and means that we can bring to bear to help them deal with that. And then assisting Indonesia in its economic form. I referred to regulatory improvements and so on. But so that's another area. And again, we have a good standing there already. The third area is are to focus on three significant economic junction points. The first is infrastructure. Again, it goes back to the maritime point, but only partially. Indonesia's infrastructure needs are well known. We've seen lots of coverage of them in the media about this. That they need enormous resources, but also expertise to develop the transportation, energy, communications, and other solutions that are required. And Canada has the kinds of solutions. Not all of them, but we have a lot of them. For instance, on the trip, we had members of someone from Bombardier came along with their solutions. We had BlackBerry involved. Again, BlackBerry is fairly big in Indonesia, communications issues, but there are other things as well that we can bring to the table. Secondly, and this is what I think is really important here in Saskatchewan, and that is working innovatively through a food security approach. Canada can provide agricultural products to feed this nation of 255 million people, where food security is an issue, while helping Indonesia develop its agricultural sector. And there's a lot of things we can do there through the provision. Of course, we sell a lot of fertilizers. Canpotex is a major exporter, and they were part of our delegation to Jakarta. Sustainable technologies in the agricultural field, nutritional advice, animal genetics and health, and so on. I think the list is almost endless. And Western Canada, and Saskatchewan in particular, has already been engaged very much in the sector. And it's my expectation that we can build on that, and that it's an important Saskatchewan value added to bring to this relationship. It's no surprise, therefore, that Saskatchewan has, between potash, wheat, and pulses and some other things, represents just over 50% of Canada's total exports to Indonesia. So Saskatchewan is a major player already in the relationship. And then third, I would say a more affluent population, more people moving into the cities and so forth, opens the doors for a sophisticated economy needs, and that is services. We already have two major Canadian insurance companies, Sun Life and Manulife. More is possible. We don't have a bank. We used to have the Bank of Nova Scotia there. They got burned at one point and decided not to go back in. But certainly financial services. We have, through our own Department of Finance, has got a project or two working there in helping finance ministry and in other ways. Management companies, engineering companies, and so on. So those three areas, I think, are sort of the core opportunity areas around this big ideas mix. And then fourth, this comes to universities, because we believe that we should be looking at youth. That if there is a country in the world, and there are a number of them, where youth represents such a large part of the population and is so important to the future of the country, we should be building those ties and relationships now, those linkages. And the best way to do it is through education. There are other ways too, exchanges, business exchanges, all kinds of things. But we should target on youth for two reasons, one of which is that when you engage young people in these sorts of activities. Those are relationships that last for a lifetime. They come back to bring benefit again and again and again. And secondly, I mean, education is, Canada has a first-class, on a global basis, educational system, both at the university level but also at the technical level. The interesting thing is that the World Bank estimates that Indonesia, by 2030, is going to have a shortfall of 9 million skilled workers, post-secondary and tertiary levels, unless they are able to strengthen the technical schools and universities in the country. Now, when you look at the number of Indonesian students in Canada, they're virtually non-existent. I think the figure that I have, anyway, is only 0.5% of foreign students in Canada come from Indonesia. So our impression from being there was that there are lots of Indonesians who'd like to come here. Financing is a bit of a problem, the distance and so forth, but the Indonesian government does have a program for the provision of the scholarships to Indonesian students to come here, to go anywhere for that matter. And I think that Canadians have to be more aggressive. And I would say Saskatchewan, University of Saskatchewan could be more aggressive in Indonesia. Given the role that Saskatchewan already plays in the relationship, there already are a lot of messaging around Saskatchewan that the University of Saskatchewan, I think, could ride in on and build on. So we could bring these students to Canada. We could also move our schools to Indonesia and partner with Indonesian schools. The one university, and this is more for the question period, but the one university that's done really well in Indonesia in terms of building relationships is McGill. And they've done it around their Islamic studies program.
Okay.
But what we're talking about here is moving beyond that to sort of real practical knowledge in sort of technical areas, but also things like engineering, accounting, business, and so on. The things that the Indonesians need most right now can come out of this university. They can come out of any Canadian university. And then one of those areas is, I think, in business. CG did organize a session with Japan on entrepreneurship, and from that I learned that we are the second most entrepreneurial country in the OECD according to OECD figures, and so again, there's no reason why Indonesia needs entrepreneurs. They were looking for them, and innovators, and again, we presumably can offer Indonesia a lot on that score. So these are the four big ideas. It provides plenty of opportunity. Now, you have to think about the relationship we want to build here. It's not a relationship where Canadians go in, make a few bucks, and come home. That's been kind of the pattern in the past, to the extent there has been one. We need to go back to where we were when Canadians were seen as sort of embedded a bit in Indonesia. We were part of the future. And so I would say that we can't be seen just as self-interested players. We need to frame our approach as one of long-term commitment to Indonesia's future, solving the food security challenge, helping build the needed infrastructure, developing modern governance systems, and so forth, securing the maritime space. So if we can package our interests in a relationship with Indonesia in those sorts of ways, the Indonesians are going to be very, very responsive. In my view, and in our view. Finally, it needs to be structured and well managed. We had the question yesterday. We met with some senior people from Saskatchewan government, and of course, you know, the in my view predictable thing is, well, you know, Saskatchewan can do so much, but it's pretty hard for us to do everything. You know, we need a federal government that's engaged there, because the federal government brings so much to the table, and they were absolutely right. So what it points out is that you can't just be single players. We need to have some kind of understanding, if you like, that we have to go in there, certainly with the federal government very present, and I'll come to a few things we can do there. But you need to have that whole of relationship approach to make this sort of thing work. So where do we start? Well, going back to one of the comments I made about awareness, I think awareness is a big issue. We're going to have to contend with that. That takes time to fix, but you got to start somewhere. And some of these initiatives I'm going to describe to you, and some of the themes that I've tried to set out for you, I think we'll do that over time. Initially, I think we'll fight that battle of a low awareness on both sides. But so as a starting point, I would say awareness always gets built in a hurry when you have a strong political presence and when you have senior level government visitors coming. They get tension in the press. They draw, interest in the visited country and so on. So I would say that we need more political engagement by our federal government, my former employer. There are some steps that were made by Mr. Harper's government before they left power. Mr. Baird went to Indonesia and reestablished a strategic, an action plan. We need to build on that action plan now. And the new government, Mr. Trudeau's father was very fond of Indonesia. I can't see reason why Mr. Trudeau Jr. couldn't be equally fond. But I do think that there's a bit of an opportunity there to convince the federal government. And when my contacts with the bureaucracy suggest that at the bureaucratic level there's a lot of interest to really sort of step up our game in terms of the political relationship. And that really means Mr. Trudeau needs to go there and President Widodo needs to come, or Jokowi needs to come to Canada. We need to have more ministers traveling in the region and bringing more ministers here. The Indonesians are actually, in the last year, I was surprised by how many ministers want to come to Canada. There was a major investment mission just in May. There was a major delegation of parliamentarians from Jakarta came. So they want to come here. We need to go the other way too. So I would say an exchange of head of government visit between now and 2020. And I would also think that and this is an ambitious idea, and as a former deputy foreign minister, I know how ambitious this idea is. It's very ambitious. And that is to create some kind of a senior ministerial steering group for the relationship. And usually that means the foreign and trade ministers, the defense minister, because security is important, and our development minister. It's kind of a core group to take an interest in this. And you could have meetings between the two opposite groups by virtually. You don't have to let distance become a problem here if you can use modern technology. And I think we need to really say to ourselves and come to an agreement with Indonesians that we are important enough to each other to be what is often called a strategic partnership. Indonesia needs to be brought up to tier one group of our relationships abroad. We have Korea in that group. We have Japan in that group. We have lots of others in that group. But Indonesia, despite what I was saying earlier about where it stands and where it's going, should be there, absolutely. Businesses need to, and I have two suggestions here. Businesses need to establish, when they won't do business in Indonesia, they need to seriously consider putting offices in Jakarta. It's too politically a complex place to do business, and more than politically complex, just generally, to do business on a successful basis without putting your own offices in there. A lot of them do it out of Singapore, which the Indonesians frankly find off-putting, or they don't do it at all. We also, I think, businesses, we need to have our business association led by the group Mr. Manley chairs to establish some kind of regular discussion with a group of Indonesian businesses. That would elevate, again, awareness as well, begin to build more networking that's going on now. We need to as well do something on the security side and perhaps mixing it with security with economic interest. I referred to the maritime space. Some years ago, we had a project with the Indonesians, set of workshops on the South China Seas. This goes back almost, two decades?
2 decades. It was 1990s.
And it was funded by CETA in those days. And when CETA pulled out the funding, they ceased. It was one of these sort of historical things where we're very fondly remembered, and including in the foreign ministry today, as a country that was ready to work with them to deal with issues even then cropping up in the South China Seas. So fisheries. Fisheries are one of the problems in the South China Seas. It's a soft zone to get into. It's not like, we're not talking about military presence or building islands or whatever. We're talking about managing fish stocks in a cooperative manner if we could bring some of our expertise together with Indonesia and co-chair something around fisheries, we think that would be, first of all, contributing to Indonesian economic interests, but also it would be contributing to greater security. And then, in pure security terms, our Navy needs to be to work on its relationships. In our delegation, we had the head of the Navy, Admiral Norman, with us. And the Canadian Navy is definitely interested in doing more. Resources is always our problem when it comes to spreading our military around the world. In economic terms, we have an idea here in our report, among some others, but I'll raise this one because it is a big idea. It's a little unconventional, but we need unconventional ideas, frankly speaking, in trade terms, given the state of the WTO and the trouble that the TPP is running into. We're even seeing maybe the European deal might fall, by the way, with Brexit. I mean, you know, the old traditional fancy, you know, and well-negotiated bilateral deals are having difficulty. Well, softer approaches might work with Indonesia. In fact, they would work with Indonesia because their resistance to sort of hard WTO-type deals has been a real historical fact. And they've said they want to join the TPP now, Mr. Jokowi, President Jokowi. So why don't we set up a council of some kind, a trade and export council, trade and investment council, something like that, made up of officials and business, kind of a, like a track two approach to economic and trade discussions, where we could talk about trade facilitation, regulatory barriers, and other things, and sort of find soft approach ideas to improve our trade. And who knows, I expect it would help condition Indonesia for making the step towards a harder, more traditional trade agreement when the time comes. And then finally, we should designate Indonesia as a country of priority under our international education strategy. I was actually surprised to find it wasn't there, given that's important, but it's not. And we should organize, and I'll throw this out in a university setting, someone needs to take the initiative and organize an EduCanada team to go to Indonesia, bringing in our technical and our university colleges, hopefully in some kind of tandem, and then head by a prominent Canadian. Why not the Governor General? But to make an impact. Again, awareness building is really key. And in my experience, big works in some places, and I think big would work in Indonesia. So the report calls a lot of other steps too, but I've chosen to be more specific about some of the things. I think the report makes good reading for those who are interested, particularly on the Saskatchewan side. There's a nice big section on agriculture, which deals with food security. You have gifts here, of course, which I would really like to get involved in this Indonesia stuff. The head of GIFS knows about Indonesia. We're sending him a copy of the report. So I think that Saskatchewan, to end on that note, really has some opportunities and openings here to be kind of in the forefront. You already are in many ways. Perhaps the university setting would provide another way to do so. So I think if we engaged in a strategic relationship that reflects our size and shared status as G20 countries, tier one type relationship, we need to establish a new basis of trust and a relationship based on shared self-interest. I think we could go places. But until then, I think we're going to be stuck with an ambivalent and inconsistent approach.
Right. Well, thank you very much. So I just want to put our colleagues in Regina on notice. I'm going to come and ask you for a question in a moment, but I'm going to start here with folks at the University of Saskatchewan and see who's going to go first and ask Lynn and Ben whatever's on your mind.
Well, whether you like it or not, you've got to like it.
I'll go first.
Go ahead, John.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Appreciate you talking to us this morning. I'm interested, of course, in your big idea number two about traditional governance issues. And you mentioned what is perhaps the biggest issue, I think, with respect to Indonesia, that it continues to fall inexorably but slowly down the Transparency International Index on corruption. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very serious issue that affects all aspects of life, including the possibility of doing business in this country.
Absolutely.
In years gone by, when I worked on forest issues, Indonesia is and remains right up as the place where large areas of natural forest are being illegally converted to palm oil plantations. And Indonesia is the major source of the great smoke clouds that hang over the rest of Southeast Asia. I mean, it's tempting to say, well, let's train some public servants to do things better. But that's surely not the way to do this, and maybe part of the problem, part of the solution to the problem. Corruption is dangerous. The people who are making money out of corrupt practices and using it to engage in political activity in Indonesia are not just going to sit back and allow new governance structures to be put in place. What's your view about how we might systematically, in a country like Indonesia, be able to tackle such a problem? Or is it, in fact, just impossible?
Well, I'm not an expert in sort of in depth on Indonesia, but you put your finger on the real problem, and that it is pervasive. It is historically comes from the colonial period. I read a great essay about a few months ago about corruption in Indonesia, which explains its sourcing and in the Dutch colonial time. So it's become deeply, deeply embedded. The current president wants to do something about it. His power is not up to the task. I think he's trying to make some changes. As you said, the international community keeps seeing the situation worse, not better. I like to think that maybe it could become better if you have a president that's actually for the first time pushing on it. But there's no one single... I don't think, as you're pointing out, I don't think there's any one single answer. It's a slow process of change in the way things work and so on. You're right. I mean, a few Canadian public servants aren't going to turn around corruption in the country, but they could help. And my guess is that when they do help, at least those that benefit from it, like even Indonesian businesses would be happy to have, I think, less bribing and sort of all this extracting of rent from a regulatory process going on, might think that Canada was actually working for them rather than against them. So I think every little bit counts, and we're not going to change it ourselves, but the funny thing is that from what we saw, we had a separate little workshop on governance issues, and all the people, mainly civil society people at this, weren't any government people. In fact, I don't think there were any government people at that workshop.
There were not.
But the enthusiasm of just sort of these ordinary, and most of them young Indonesians, to fix the problem was, I thought, outstanding. I mean, I was really impressed by that. And they were asking for more Canadian help. We need you there. We need your example and all of this. Both in dealing with that issue, but also just helping them practice democracy, everything from running of elections to transparency issues and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, we're not going to change Indonesia, but we can certainly be there to help.
Go ahead, Bill. Yeah, if I can add, I'd like to point out that, as you mentioned, Len, President Jokowi has made an effort to combat corruption, and he ran largely on a platform of anti-corruption and clean government. He has set up an agency, an anti-corruption agency. One of the problems that President Jokowi has ran into is the fact that he is running with a divided polity. He doesn't have majority, I believe, at the moment, or... the entrenched interests in Indonesian society have, to a large part, cut the grass under the feet of the supposedly independent anti-corruption agency. And they have not conducted their work that they were set up to do. But there is a real effort and a real recognition under Jokowi, more than any other president before, that this corruption issue needs to be combated. So at least it's the first good step in the right direction, setting up the agency, and that the will is there. But obviously, as you mentioned, it's such a deeply entrenched problem that it will not be eradicated under one single government. But there is some hope, I believe.
Let's go to Regina. Colleagues in Regina, any questions?
I could ask a question. I'm wondering what the implications are of rising sea levels to a country like Indonesia that's made primarily of islands. How much of their land might they lose?
The rising sea level affects Indonesia. If I can just answer, unless you want to go ahead on that. I remember having a conversation with one of our participants at the workshop, and as far as we talked a little bit about this, and Indonesia, I believe, is not, most of this island are not under any imminent danger, as opposed to some other islands in the Pacific, like Palau or Nauru. Some of these islands. So as far as I know, I don't know if Len, you have anything to add to that, but I'm not too familiar with this issue. But I do not think it's one of the main, it looms, it's so large on Indonesia's radar at the moment, the sea level issue.
But if you could just build on that for a second, Jeremy referenced the environmental damage associated with burning off of fossil fuels or of wood. So what is the environmental record of Indonesia, and is there a sensitivity to that internationally or in any other way?
The burning is a real issue because it affects other countries in the region. Singapore, Malaysia have continuously complained to the authorities in Indonesia to curtail on this practice. But this practice is so widespread on some of these far-flung islands that it's very difficult to root out. It's an issue that they will need to, if they want to keep being seen as a leader in the region and maintain good relations with their neighbors, they will have to work on that because it deeply affects some of the neighboring countries.
Yeah. So another question here in Saskatoon. Go ahead, Karen.
I'll ask you the
mic. All right. Yeah, just need to put it on the table. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you very much. That was very interesting. I guess I'm curious as to what's been the response to these proposals so far. I think you've got a very comprehensive strategy there, but it's also a very resource. It would require a fair amount of effort and money. And are there people making the case for other countries in the region, for example, Vietnam, that are also saying we need to pay more attention? And I guess I'm sort of wondering, when you talk about awareness, I mean, even those that are on the Tier 1 list, as you know, like Japan and South Korea, there's not a lot of, you know, when you really come down to it, there's been that much Canadian attention even to those over the last number of decades. So I guess I'm just wondering what you think the response will be and how easy a road this is and what kind of competition you see for that, for this attention.
Well, that's a very good question, because when you're inside government, the last thing you want to hear is a speech like you've just heard, because it forces decisions around the allocation of resources and priorities, right?
Yeah.
And I know full well, having lived through that, that we are posing some pretty big questions, but now that I'm no longer a public servant, whereas before I couldn't. So. I think it's time to challenge some of these sort of basic assumptions about are we an Asia-Pacific country or are we not, first of all. And if we're not going to be, and we decide not to be, then, well, we can continue our current behaviors, but we're going to find the consequences will be that we are not going to be at the center of the economic and political activity of Asia, and given the economic power of the region, we're not going to be affecting the decisions, really, that are going to be shaping global outcomes, you know, in the future. So I don't believe, you know, I believe a strong relationship with Indonesia does more than simply improve our relationship with Indonesia. It improves our strategic position in the Asia-Pacific world. It will help us deal more confidently with a powerful China. It will help us remend, to some extent, I think, some of our other relationships in the region, because we're a player and we have, as they say in the game, skin in the game, right? So I think you know, you've got to be bold. Now, the decision makers in Ottawa will have to decide whether they're ready to put additional resources into Asia or take them from somewhere else. We've done it in the past. I mean, I've seen over the last several decades, we have moved lots of resources. In fact, I've made some of the decisions to do so out of Europe into Asia. Mm-hmm. We went through a real shift in those resources back in the 80s and 90s. It was quite marked, much to the dislike of the Europeanists in my own former department. But, you know, we've kind of ground to a halt. We're not doing as much. We're doing some, but not as much as we need to do. So when you talk to the bureaucracy in Ottawa, as we roll this thing out, and I'm in my own private context, I think there's a lot of interest in this. But it requires some strategic decisions. And, you know, with the Middle East and the situation it's in and the attention that we pay to the Middle East and the Syrian problem, which is an enormous problem, and humanitarian terms, a disaster, you know, our eyes tend to be drawn to the European or to the Middle East theaters very easily and very quickly, for good reason. So to try and make people think about Indonesia is a long shot. I know that. But if we don't do something, you know, we'll pay a price down the road. So. And I'm also, you know, you also get the question, well, you've asked for a lot, and, you know, we can't do that. My answer is, well, if you can't do a lot, what can you do? Mm-hmm. And do something, because do more than we're doing right now. Because, I mean, the trajectory of this country is clear. The problems it faces are enormous. The challenges we face in building that relationship are enormous. But the payoff down the road, I think, will more than make up for the effort we put into it now.
Okay, great. Regina, any questions from you?
Go ahead. You mentioned education as as an opportunity for cooperation, particularly universities and technical institutes. And often when we talk about education, we jump all the way up to universities and technical institutes, which in my mind rest on the shoulders of the elementary and secondary systems, if you want to talk about youth. What can you share in terms of knowledge about Indonesia in terms of their elementary and secondary systems, as we refer to them as, in terms of what are their successes and what are their challenges, where there might also be some opportunities for a cooperation?
Well, Benoit may have some more insights on this than I do, but I've got in the reading I did and some of the anecdotal stories I've heard, suggests that the school system in Indonesia generally has some serious problems. They don't pay teachers enough. A lot of the teachers don't even teach. They just stay at home. They're sinecures. They're run by local communities and local governments and so on. So the educational system in Indonesia is very weak. Like that. That's. I'm not suggesting we. At least we didn't suggest in here. We tackled that too, and we haven't. Our aid program has not spent a lot. At least they haven't in recent times been involved too much in sort of supportive education. But it's a real problem, as you say. And I don't know. Maybe there are ideas on this table, or you have them that we could bring to bear. I don't know, Ben.
Yeah, we did not focus much on the primary or secondary education in our project and at this report, so I don't have much to add to what you said, but this is something that certainly I heard through some of the younger people on some of our workshops that as Len pointed out, the education system at all levels except the public system at least is quite deficient in many respects, so yep. Yes, but we will not tackle that.
So that that does tend to be a bit of a pattern with autocracies or former autocracies, where the investment in public education is significantly, well, demonstrably low. And part of the strategy here is to have a population that is not actually that well educated. Mm-hmm. You go to the interests of ruling groups inside society, and they don't see any particular moral necessity, and they also see some political problems with an increasing and robust education system. So it goes kind of tracks on back to the first question that Jeremy asked about, and Len, you just referred to those sinecures that we also see in other countries. So it strikes me. The other thing I just mentioned to you, I'm starting to read literature that says that levels of education, aggregate levels of education in these countries, are actually the key to long-term development, notwithstanding all the other strategies, that if you can get fairly significant investment in primary and secondary education, get people's education levels up, then the whole society seems to be, I mean, the social consequences seem to be uniformly positive. But it is a long-term strategy, and you mentioned the youth. I guess I just wonder whether, you know, Canadians could make a contribution. Although, you know, we've talked about this before. I mean, we are in a kind of uniquely problematic situation because all of our education systems are managed at the provincial level. Gathering the provinces up or to create a kind of national strategy or the kind of work that you're talking about, Len, would be particularly difficult. And yet I'm wondering whether the payback over the next 15 or 20 years might not be the strongest in that area. Anyway, I'm just speculating now, and I guess I was just, and you've already told us that that hasn't been a focus.
Well, you're right, if I can just add that. Canadian institutions, some of them I've already done certain inroads in Indonesia. I mean, you mentioned McGill University. There's LaSalle College as well that has some programs in Indonesia. Humber College as well that has some programs in Indonesia. So there is a possibility, there is room and even demand to a certain extent for educational initiatives coming from abroad in Canada. So yes, as you mentioned, we haven't gone that far in our project, but given the fact, looking at what we've done so far, there is more that we can do at other levels of education under such programs. So primary.
I take your point that if 50% of Canada's exports to Indonesia are coming out of this province, We should probably take a look at ourselves and say, like, what is the province of Saskatchewan doing with our limited resources on a variety of fronts? I don't think we've had a single student from Indonesia, for example, in the School of Public Policy. I may be wrong about that. And we've had students from all parts of the globe here.
Right.
And yet Indonesia is kind of a big blank for us. And so I think your challenge is the correct one. This province probably needs to take a look in Indonesia at least as closely as others. So let's have another question from here in Saskatoon. Go ahead. Yeah, believe it or not, those mics are really very good, but it's better if they're close.
I think my voice protects as well as yours. So I'm coming from the healthcare background here, and Len, I haven't heard anything in that regard yet, but just what you were talking about in terms of the long-term payback from educational development that I see in terms of through a healthcare lens, like education and poverty aspects were things that I saw in the background to today's presentation that brought me here. And I was wondering, when you mentioned your first of the four natural drivers that bring us together, that geographic challenge that Canada has, I'm wondering if in terms of shared similarities and challenges, you see links between issues that Indonesia is facing right now with poverty and educational aspects needing development, and healthcare in the sense of how we could learn from each other. You mentioned them being an economic engine business-wise for Asia. In terms of where they're at right now with healthcare and the challenges that Canada faces with healthcare, I'm wondering if you see some sort of linkage there in a relationship, the development for long-term strategy that can help us both.
Well, interesting question. We did not look at this sector as, and that doesn't mean that there couldn't be a potential there. It's just that it's not one of the sectors that popped up in our initial scan, and then we focused in on those that did, right? So that's why we did the sectors I've mentioned, agriculture particularly, the CETA programming, now the foreign GAC programming, GAC programming, is now focusing in very much on these two areas of governance and so on and economic opportunity. And I'm not aware if we've ever had all that much on the health side. And, you know, I know that there's a review underway now in Ottawa from the former CETA to look at, under the new government, whether or not to shift any of the priorities from on official development assistance. But I haven't seen anything to suggest we might be into the health area.
Although what's interesting is this morning's discussion when you touched on food insecurity, I know in the College of Pharmacy and Nutrition, they have many grads or a good number of grad students working on research in terms of food insecurity pulses that links into agriculture. So the nutritional aspects that are being researched that link right into the poverty. So there's that linkage that I see in terms of the upstream social determinants of health that can be developed educationally, food insecurity-wise, that link right into the long-term payback of a more stable society, big picture. So that lens of healthcare, not meaning the what we typically think of with healthcare in terms of the hospital environment,
primary care or whatever.
Yeah. So thanks for your answer.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sort of bring it into the nutrition dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any recollections on any of this?
Do not. Not about that.
No.
So colleagues in Regina, any questions, comments? No?
I think we're good in Regina.
Okay. Anything else here? Yes, go ahead.
What I'm hearing is your report and your focus is on business, economic development, and the comments I'm hearing are more on governments, democracy, equality, solving social problems. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to hear those comments. Mm-hmm. It seems to me if you're talking about a long-term relationship, get our business there, get your head offices there. Just as a citizen and as a Canadian, I would rather see our long-term, our strategy for long-term relationship with a country, any country, be based on our expertise and our ability to be the best democracy we possibly can, solve our own issues, and share with people how we are sharing mm-hmm. seriously those issues of equality, of the gap between rich and poor, of education. These seem to me, if Canada was an exemplary country in the world, that could then develop relations. I think the economics should come after that, or along with it. But I think the lead, I think for long-term development and relationship as a global community in a world that I think is under a bit of stress, mm-hmm. Is from the heart rather than from economic terms. I'm seeing that, I guess, in the books I'm seeing coming out on economics mm-hmm. and the disconnect between economics and real democracy.
Yeah. Well, you may have something there. You know, I admit I have my own biases, which are not in the same direction as yours. I tend to think the two things go hand in hand. I think as a country, we're driven to earn our living in the world, and that presupposes us to put a lot of weight on the economic dimension. But that said, what we have tried to set out here is to deal with to ensure that the relationship we have is multifaceted, and that a good piece of it does focus on the issues of democratic development and so forth to help this young and still unpracticed democracy mature and become truly representative. One of the suggestions we have in here, which I haven't referred to, is actually to create what we were calling a citizens coalition between Canadian and Indonesian citizens groups, which would meet some of the points you're making to develop these relationships at the citizen-to-citizen level and civil society-to-civil society level as part of a set of economic linkages and a set of political linkages. And of course, what's in here, of course, is the whole notion of a nation's security, which Indonesians, you know, we are a very secure place compared to, you know, the Indonesian situation with both internal issues, although they have been able to take care of sort of internal terrorism issues. They're very worried about ISIS. They have radicalization taking place in their communities. They have been affected and not reacted very well, frankly, to the refugees from Myanmar, the Rohingya. So these are all sort of things that where we can bring pieces to the table. So if I've emphasized the economic, I do so because that tends to be where I come from in my own experience and you know, basic approach. But I'm fully aware of, and we made sure that this relationship is more than simply money and trade and economic. But it has to be. It has, and the point we're trying to make, that we have to make these relationships based on their self-interest as well as our own. And truly lasting relationships are built on that formula. And my experience, one's in Asia, particularly because of the importance of relationships.
So do you think this new government, Len, is looking for foreign direct investment? Imagine it is. But I'm just curious because... the new Indonesian government.
Well, that's what the president is saying.
Yeah.
But there are a number of things going on in the country that he is allowing to happen, which are discouraging it. One of which was the discouraging of non-Indonesian language documentation and so forth, the use of English and foreign languages. And I have to mention it because it's there in front of us, and I didn't mention it. There's this awful case of Neil Bantleman, who has been... Yeah. Sent to prison and reconvicted at least once on the basis of no evidence at all that he and others were involved in a child molestation case at an international school. And there have been joint demarches, not only by the Canadian government, which has been in a jam on this one, because they have to be seen to be very, and they are generally working very, very hard to get Mr. Bantleman released. But other countries have jointly protested, raised this with the Indonesian government, that if you want to attract investors to Indonesia, you better ensure that when they come with their families, that they're not thrown in jail on these sorts of, totally unfounded charges, and it would appear that the case involves that of a parent or a family in the school that is trying to extract money from the school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Through you know, in Indonesia, problems get solved, as they do in many countries, by the payments.
Yeah.
So.
Well, excellent point.
Yeah, but he is definitely the current president is definitely emphasized. He's a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been emphasizing the importance of investment. And he's reappointed a new investment minister. That investment minister was just here in Canada with a delegation of Indonesian business people last month. So, they have, interestingly, having gone through the Harper years where we were talking about economic diplomacy for Canada, he has talks about economic diplomacy for Indonesia. And his foreign ministry is going through the same catharsis that ours did, when the leader said, your job number one is creating economic opportunity for Indonesia abroad.
Yeah. Well, all of this provides leverage, right? I mean, to make changes to the society. And I, you know, one of the things you've said and you came back to is the apparent health of social, civil society groups. I mean, and your idea of a connection between civil society groups in both countries. I mean, I know you had other ideas about what would be truly difficult to do, but that strikes me as perhaps even more innovative in terms of kind of coming to terms with governance and governance practices by getting civil society groups together to talk about what good governance actually looks like from their perspective. I mean, that's just an observation, not a question.
It's a very powerful observation, actually, and...
Well, this is why we held that workshop there. We had a one-day workshop just on these issues, because there's already quite a few Canadian organizations doing very good work on that front in Indonesia. Collaboration. It's not only about us showing them how to do things, but some real two-way collaboration. And so, yeah, this the very broad area of governance innovation is something that I think that bodes quite positive for the future, the two nations.
That's good. So final question from Regina. This is your last chance. Okay, go ahead.
You mentioned if we could add a comment, and if you want to comment on it, that's fine. But just as a follow-up on my previous question about education, and I think related to all of the other comments and questions that have been made, it's an encouragement. I would encourage you to increase your investigation into education in a broader spectrum, the elementary and the secondary, the elementary and the secondary, beyond university and technical institutes. Obviously, I've been involved in many levels of education for a long time, and that's why it's a burning interest with many different demographics. The skills and knowledge and attitudes and things that you're looking to develop, you know, quite frankly, are largely already developed in the population that attends university and technical institutes. And together, they form not the majority of the population. I think it's critical that in many areas that we think, it seems like nobody wants to work with the kids, you know, because kids are kids and they're maybe not as predictable and easy to work with, etc., as university and technical levels. And yet all of those are on the shoulders of universities and technical institutes. And there's a whole bunch of population that's lost in development because they don't go to university and technical institutes. We know that. So it's an encouragement that I think in all venues we need to increase. And in terms of not just skills and knowledge, but attitudes and cooperation and harmony, if you want to use that word, which, you know, if we increase harmony in the world, there's a lot of savings, as we know over the last while, that could be realized. I think it's a truly forgotten area, and I would just encourage you to push further down the, when I say down, I don't mean that obviously in a derogatory way, down the educational scale, especially if you're really talking long term. Because that's where the long-term benefits lie.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Any question here? And go ahead.
Yeah, I'll come back with another economic question. I see, when I was looking at the trade data earlier, I see that Saskatchewan's export growth to Indonesia is driven almost exclusively by wheat in the last couple of years. And you know, that's an area where we're facing more and more competition from Australia and the Asia Pacific region. And I saw that Australia is really ramping up its negotiations with Indonesia and developing some of those trade agreements. So I wonder about the sustainability of that trade growth that we are seeing right now if we aren't able to diversify more. You talked about a very long-term, big-picture strategy for trade engagement with Indonesia, but I'm wondering if there are some opportunities that small and medium-sized businesses need to be aware of right now in terms of exports to Indonesia.
Well, you're right about wheat, and of course, with the abolition of the wheat board, there's not just the wheat board now. There's a whole bunch of other smaller companies selling wheat, like Cargill, Canadian Branch, and others. That's a side comment from my experience in agriculture, you know, the pulses are a really big growth item. I don't know if you know Murad Al-Khatib, who heads a company out of Regina, now a very successful pulse exporter. He told me that Indonesia is now his fastest growing market, and he just started from almost zero there a few years ago. So expect pulses to become bigger. He had a small company. It's no longer a small company. What's your definition? But I mean, that's always been the problem of with our agricultural sector, is that marketing is usually done by the big companies. So, you know, that's why the wheat pool system and the I'm a farmer from Saskatchewan, a kid from farming Saskatchewan, so I'm a great believer in the wheat board, the pool system, both of which have gone the way of the dodo bird, but big companies have taken their place. So I think there's lots of potential, and you do have, you know, this, to make a pitch for our trade commissioner service in Canada and our embassies around the world, is that they work very well with smaller and medium-sized companies. In fact, that's one of the things that big companies don't need the help of the Canadian government representatives abroad. It's the smaller companies that do. So I hope that once awareness grows of the import of the, that their market exists there, that these small companies will be in touch with the government of Canada and their trade commissioner service.
Hopefully we'll see some of those same export missions happening there. It's all China.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be nice to see some more going on.
Exactly. Well, then, and Ben, this has been really quite, you've raised awareness, so you've got that, your first task
success.
Completed, that's for sure. And I think you've got a little bit of feedback, and interest in Indonesia is obviously going to be quite a bit higher as a result of all of this. Congratulations on taking the lead here. I hope that you will follow through and CG will continue to be interested in Indonesia, because as you all know, one of the problems we have in Canada is finding partners to do get things done, and people who know people, as it were. And I think the University of Regina, the University of Saskatchewan, I mean, if there were opportunities to get engaged in public service education, I mean, you've made the point, and my big takeaway is this has got to be a two-way street. The new relationship with Indonesia, it's got to be just, you know, it's not just about economics. It's got to be about looking at the long-term future of Indonesia and how Canada can contribute to that. So you've done a great job of telling us all about the opportunity. So thank you both very much. Thank you, Regina, for being part of that. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for your attention, and thank you very much for your advice and ideas. I've taken note of them, including education ideas and so on. Definitely.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. But just as a very quick comment, this is not the end of the project. We're going forward. We're going to hold a second forum next year, 2017. So, yes, we will explore all of these, and it's not the end.